We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
My name's Chris. I am an addict and alcoholic. By the grace of God, I've been sober all day today. And I've also been sober since at least May 1st, 2002. I'm coming up on 18 years. I say at least because I don't actually remember my exact sobriety date. And if I did, it would be sometime around now. I have one of those rock bottom real alcoholic kind of stories where I heard voices for the first few weeks of sobriety. It was very cloudy and I don't really remember, so I err on the side of caution by about 2 months. So I believe, and I was just talking about this with a sobriety brother of mine who I'm very, very close with. I consider him to be like a best friend. His name is Royce. From here locally in the Bay Area, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. He got sober about 5 or 6 months before me. So it's some kind of a gauge, but again, I like to err on the side of caution, and I've been picking up chips this way for, you know, several years, and I like seeing the same people every year. So May 1st, 2002 is the sobriety date that I claim. And I've been sober ever since by the grace of God and often in spite of myself. I say that often. Matter of fact, every time I speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's always the same. My name's Chris. I'm an addict and alcoholic, and by the grace of God, I've been sober all day today. There's a reason for that, which I'll get into in a little while. It has a whole lot to do with this in my life. I wrote down some notes, and I'm going to try to keep to some kind of a format here with the notes. One of the things that I like to kind of qualify or explain in open meetings, which I try to treat these as, is what an alcoholic is. I'm an addict alcoholic, and people will get a little fussy about that. Whether you're, depending on which fellowship you're in, they don't like the alcoholic part, or they don't like the addict part, or whichever it is, they might get a little fussy about the way that I happen to say that. And there's a specific reason that I do, and it's because if I ever happen to find myself in the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, I want someone who's an alcoholic there to know that it is possible, to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous as well. And I want any drug addicts that find their way into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous to know that, like them, I got sober in AA, not NA. So I'm one of the weird ones. I got sober entirely in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did it the old-fashioned way. There's lots of people that get clean and sober in Narcotics Anonymous, so I'm not a basher of the 12 steps in any form or any format or any fellowship. This is just my story, and I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. I really just speak for me. One of the best metaphors I ever heard came from this crotchety old man named Bob C. I got sober in the Hayward Fellowship, which is located in San Leandro, California, not Hayward, which is a little ironic, and we always thought that was funny. The Hayward Fellowship had this old man named Bob. Bob C, he was cranky, and he was an older guy, and he didn't necessarily like having addicts in his AA meetings. But ironically, something that he said once resonated with me so much, and it is actually what I point to every time the subject comes up. And he told me the story. He said, you know, if you take 30 random people, let's put Jesus in there, let's put Mother Teresa, let's get Gandhi and Buddha, think of the best people that you can possibly dream up, and put them all in a room and force feed them heroin for 30 days. What do you think is going to happen when they come out of there? And I said, well, they're probably going to need more heroin. And he nodded his head and he said, yeah. And then he said, now take 30 random people, put them all into a room and force feed them alcohol for 30 days. And see, this is specifically, it's intimate to me. This is personal to me because they did that to my father in the Betty Ford Clinic, one of his first rehabs. And they did that. Yeah, they took 30 people. They would put them in a room and they would force feed them alcohol all day long. And they do this for 30 days straight. And then Bob said, well, what do you think happened after that? And I thought, and I didn't say anything for a long time. And he says, now you get it. Because see, normal people probably wouldn't want to touch it again for a long, long time. There's going to be a couple people that just the smell of it, they're going to associate it with throwing up. It's going to make them sick to their stomach. They're not going to want to drink for a very long time. But there's that one. There's one that's going to be so upset that he got kicked out and he can't stay an extra day. And that's me. And whether it's drugs or whether it's alcohol, that describes me to a T. Because the thing is, there are a lot of people who are physically and chemically dependent on drugs. Now, right now we have this epidemic, opioid epidemic. There are a lot of people who are taking medications that should take medication, especially the elderly. They're physically dependent, and if you abruptly stop their medication, there's going to be a problem. That's not an addict. And, you know, when I think of an alcoholic, I'm thinking about the disease, the spiritual malady that Dr. Silkworth and the doctor's opinion outlined and how they described what this is, the ism. So Bob's Z's metaphor, analogy, whatever the proper term is, it makes perfect sense to me because I am different. I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. The action that it has on me is different than a regular person. There's that phenomenon of craving that develops that I have little to no control once I've started. But then there's that mental obsession that it doesn't matter how smart I am, how intelligent I am, how high my IQ is, my background, my upbringing. There's no respecter of demographics for alcoholism. That ism, it's a powerful, you know, we say cutting, baffling, powerful, in the rooms. And, it's what makes me who I am. It's what makes me different than regular people. It will get me every time. And no matter how bright or, you know, affable or, you know, no matter how well I succeed at life and convince myself that I'm smarter and elevate myself above other people with my ego, my mind can rationalize just about anything. And that's what happened to me, throughout my disease, throughout my addiction, throughout my drinking. I thought that I was choosing to do all these things. I thought I was choosing to drink. I thought I was choosing to use. So the guilt and the shame and the blame and the remorse and all the pity that I would have to then in turn stuff down with more alcohol and more drugs was this vicious cycle. And it all kind of came from pride in the reverse, that I was under this misguided impression that I was in control. And I would fight and I'd be very defensive and very sensitive about that idea because I really truly believed I was choosing to do these things. Now, regular people, non-alcoholics and people that don't have much familiarity with the program, I've heard over the years, you know, they'll think of this as a cop-out. You know, we've lost the power of control. That must mean that we're not taking any responsibility for our actions. And there's something very important that the man who got me sober, my sponsor, Ed S., from the Hayward Fellowship, had written in his book that he had given to me early on in sobriety. And it said simply, not to be blamed, but responsible for. And that's the ticket. That's the thing. My alcoholism and my addiction, who I am, my ism, this malady, is not my fault, but I am responsible for it. And I think that's the thing that the general public probably struggles to understand, is that we're not saying that we're not responsible and that we're not accountable for absolutely everything that we do. What we are saying is that a real alcoholic has lost the power of choice somewhere along the line, and we often can't really tell when or where it happened. In my notes in here, there's this strawberry story that I just love. It's kind of like being addicted to strawberries, but we have an allergy to strawberries. And every time we eat strawberries, we get hives, we puff up our our throats close up, and we end up in the emergency room, and we're seconds from death. And we're sitting there in the emergency room in the hospital bed, and the doctor is explaining that, you know, son, if you would have just eaten one more strawberry, you would be dead right now. And the whole time, all we hear is wah, 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 wah. And we're thinking, if I could just get out of here, I could have another strawberry. And the first thing that we do, the minute we're released from the hospital, is run across the street to go find some more strawberries. It's insanity, right? But we don't see it that way at that time. In my life, it's the kind of thing that would convince me to quit a job making tons of money to go sell drugs and be a bum and end up homeless. It seems so rational at the time, and it seems like my voice, my thoughts. And what I've learned is that it's not. My mind really is out to get me, and that's my disease talking to me. I've heard twice, and two different grandfathers of mine. I have one that's passed. I have one that I'm blessed to still live in, that have been great influences on my life. I've heard at different points in my life, whether childhood or adulthood, oh, he was an alcoholic. And they weren't, and they aren't. It gets right back to what I was saying, that, you know, many people think of an alcoholic as somebody who just drinks a lot. They drink every day. They drink a lot a day. Maybe they're not too nice to be around. Maybe they're kind of a prick. They think of that as an alcoholic, or they think of the bum in the street as an alcoholic. And what they don't see is that a heavy drinker, a problematic drinker, does not necessarily an alcoholic make. And it's the same thing when we get back to, you know, the prescription drugs and chemical dependency. Just because someone has become chemically dependent does not make them one of us. There are plenty of people who are entirely normal, who just got physically dependent on something. They work with their doctor. They work their way out of it. They go on to live completely normal lives because they are completely normal people. And they're not like me, and they're not like the rest of us. And I think it's important that we distinguish the difference. I always thought I was deciding to drink or use, and that blame and that guilt and that remorse was haunting. For me, my story, the first thing that I remember that I could describe as alcoholic behavior, I did not have a good childhood. I had a terrible childhood. I was very sad, very lonely kid. I rarely talk about it. I had the kind of mother who probably should not have had kids. And today, you know, at coming up on 18 years sober, I can see that she did the best that she could with what she had and what she was capable of. Other people are sick too in different ways, and other people have handicaps of different sorts. It's not my job to take her inventory. It's my job to take my inventory. So I try to steer away from, you know, talking too much about other people, except where it's necessary. So I can describe my childhood as really sad. The very first time I was ever allowed to go visit and hang out with another friend after school, I got into a lot of trouble because we had convinced this kid's mom that we were allowed to go outside, and we weren't. And I got all scratched up because we were playing in the bushes. And the apartment manager found out about it, and she knew how my mom was. And she called her, and my mom came and tracked me down, and I was in big trouble. And all I remember is that she was on the phone yelling and screaming at the top of her lungs at this woman. And I had that, oh, crap feeling in the back of the house because I knew I was going to get it. And I was scratched up and I didn't feel good. And something in my head told me that I needed to solve that. And so what I did is I got into the medicine cabinet and I got a bottle of formula 44D, which my mom gave me when I was actually sick, because I wanted to feel well. I wanted to be well. And I justified it with these scratches. Now, I'm describing a first or second grader. So this is very, very young. I poured the exact correct amount, measured it out, and I took it. And this little thought went off in my head that if one is good, two must be better. And so I took another one and I measured it out and I took another shot of formula 44D. And my mom smelled it on my breath immediately and, you know, asked me, oh my God, you know, or you could die, or were you trying to commit suicide? And, you know, I wanted to avoid a spanking. I wanted to avoid getting my butt whooped because that was exactly what would happen. I was a kid who had a prison sentence to my room my entire childhood. I lived in my room. I did not eat dinner with family when I was at home. I came out to eat dinner by myself. I was in my room from the minute I got home until the minute I went to bed. As I got older and into junior high, that turned into, you know, a stripped down bedroom that was essentially a cell. I can remember, you know, sticking my nose up against the screen and the smell kind of like matches from the screen, because I was just smelling the outside air, wishing that I could be outside. I did not have a great childhood, but that was the first time that I did something like an alcoholic, where that little voice convinced me that two must be better. So, you know, throughout that kind of psychologically weird, you know, very lonely life of solitude as a child, this was the late 80s and the early 90s. I grew up in a rough-ish neighborhood in the Bay Area. You know, this was the era of gold rims and Daytons and lowriders, and everyone had a red rag or a blue rag. I got beat up a lot. I was a scrawny little kid, and it was pretty much a daily event. I had to walk to school, and, you know, the walk to school was several miles. There was really no way to get there without getting beat up. There was really no way to get home without getting beat up. It wasn't fun. So I get it all day at school to the point where, you know, there'd be these big fights and I'd get spit on and kicked and, you know. And then I would come home and go to my cell and then I would get into, you know, little kinds of trouble. It was an extremely religious, radically religious house. And, I can remember, you know, being told that I was evil was a regular occurrence in that house. And it wasn't because I was making like satanic pictures or doing anything over the top crazy. It was because I would sneak, you know, I'd sneak into the pantry and I'd grab a bag of chips or, you know, something like that. And I was breaking the rules and sneaking around and betraying her trust. And, I remember one time in particular, I had gotten in big trouble for stealing a bag of chips. And it was a big enough deal that she called my stepdad to take off work and come home and, you know, give me a big spanking. And I was terrified and shaking, and I did that thing that we do where, you know, we put on the sad eyes hoping that that might help. And I said, you know, but Mom, do you still love me? And I can remember like it happened yesterday. She looked me dead in the eyes and she said, how can I love a child that's so evil? And so that's kind of been, you know, a regular thing that has followed me throughout my life. Where, you know, either by me seeking it out or just by experiences that I've been through, I saw life as a very hostile, harsh, cold place to be. Something that I had to survive rather than something to enjoy. Anyway, I spent weekends at my grandparents' house, and I often call them my university. They were my, I credit them with my career. I credit them with most of my morals. They are my, you know, they were my, moral compass and still are in a lot of ways. They taught me a lot. I read a lot of books. They taught me a lot of things. They were computer savvy and tech savvy way ahead of their time. I was programming computer games and Atari Basic when I was in elementary school, and reading books that were way ahead of my age group, thanks to her. She taught me etiquette. She's the reason that I can be affable and you know, blend and fit in a suburban environment or a corporate environment for work. It really all comes down to her and to him and what they taught me and what they gave me. Those basic principles that I learned from them. Without them, I don't know that I would be where I am. So in junior high, which is what we called it back then, you know, that's when things started to kind of come to a head and I started to finally rebel. It got to be a little bit too much. And, you know, this really puts a date on me, but, I started breakdancing as a way of some kind of an outlet. I was always an artist, which was one of the few things I was limited to being allowed to do, as long as it didn't look, too magical, at home. I didn't have a whole lot of outlets. So breakdancing became a thing. And some of the cool kids, accepted me. And, eventually, by this point, my mom was letting me come home a half hour late, which meant that I could stop at, Jimmy's house around the corner on my way home from school. We would breakdance in his garage. And eventually that led to, you know, the first time smoking weed and the first time drinking anything. I managed to convince her that my eyes were red because they had a pool. And, I don't know that she really believed me, but she let it pass. I kind of started to get through junior high that way. And, I remember hating weed. I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all. I told myself I'd never do it again. And yet I did every time they offered it. I still don't, like weed. I really never did. I just did it because it was there and, it made me feel different. And everybody else was doing it, and it was better than what I had. Not every alcoholic has a rough childhood. Like I said, this is no respecter of demographics. I've seen people who were filthy rich, who have come into the program still having two houses, and a boat and all these cars, and they didn't have difficult childhoods at all. This is just my story. I'll fast forward a little bit. I did have a few memories of my dad that I did not grow up with. I got the classic, just like your father. And, I heard all the stories of why he was a terrible person, why he was a drug addict, why he was an alcoholic, that he used to beat her. I heard a lot of things to teach me that he wasn't the greatest person in the world. But I did meet him when I was a teenager. And I mistook him for my substitute teacher when he asked me if I knew who he was. But his eyes were red and my eyes were red, and we immediately had something in common. And so we started hanging out, and we found a way to, on my way, that walk home from school, he made a point of walking at the same time and signing it. Just within a month, we had come up with a plot and a scheme and a plan. And my mother signed rights away and let me move in with the man that she had said was this horrible, awful person my entire life. Within a month, she described it as, we give up. We've tried everything. By this time, I had stopped going to school pretty much completely because I kept getting beat up. So I wasn't really going to school. I lived with my dad for a total of 3 months, and in that first 3 months, I had my first real hardcore drugs. I had my first, real drinks. Shots of Crown Royal were his thing. There was plenty of Budweiser stocked in the fridge all the time, which was perfectly acceptable. His one and only rule is never bring the cops. And one night I walked out into the garage in the middle of the night, because I had drank too much to go to sleep, and I couldn't sleep because I had drunk so much. And I heard something in the garage. I went out there and I saw him bent over smoking something weird. And my immediate thought wasn't something bad. My immediate thought, I said, well, what's that? And he said, well, this is crank. And I said, well, what does it do? So there was never any fear, despite having participated in DARE and Just Say No and all these required school things about how drugs are bad. You know, that's not what went on in my head. What went on in my head is, how's it going to make me feel? And, you know, he had this thing that, you know, it was like his mantra, which was, he didn't want to be a hypocrite. And so he said, well, I'm not going to be a hypocrite. I'm not going to tell you not to do something that I do. So, go ahead and try. And I tried, and I tell you, it again, it's just like it was yesterday. The minute it hit my chest, it was like I was alive for the first time. And I thought, why can't I always be like this? And that's my disease for me. That's alcoholism. We call that addiction because we happen to be talking about drugs at this moment. Yeah, that's what it is. It's, I felt normal for the first time in my life. Everything felt perfect. I chased that feeling. I chased that feeling for a long, long time after that. So living with him didn't last long. I mean, he was a train wreck. He was a tornado. He was definitely no role model. He was irresponsible. He couldn't pay the rent. He couldn't keep things up. All of my firsts happened in that house in that first 3 months. I lost my virginity on drugs. I had my first taste of being somewhat cool, because now I was somewhat acceptable. Some of the cool kids would come over because we were allowed to smoke weed and drink at my new house. I used that as a way to kind of fit in and get some kind of acceptance. And it was short-lived. I ended up in group homes and foster homes for the next several years, which, despite all the scary stories, were miles better by far than anything I had grown up with, aside again from my grandparents' house. I can remember, you know, I moved into this group home in Livermore, which is in wine country here in the Bay Area. And, it was so vastly different from the quote unquote ghetto area that I grew up when, I felt like an outsider all over again. And, it was weird for me, but, within, I'd say within about a matter of a month, you know, I started to realize that this place was vastly different. Here, I wasn't getting beat up. Here, actually, they thought I was the cool kid. Here, I was the cool kid from the, you know, from the mean streets. And, all the boys wanted to dress like me and all the girls wanted to date me. And it was a radical, you know, flip flop, that was night and day on everything used to. So I had a great experience in what I did in high school, which didn't last that long. I'm a freshman dropout. My school, Livermore High, had a smoking section. That puts another data on my age. And I can remember making fun of smokers that, you know, after they finished doing anything or started doing anything, they had to have a cigarette. And again, within weeks, I became a smoker. It's a theme here, you know, that I would not understand these people, and I would talk trash, and then I would end up being one of them very quickly. But I pined, you know, at night. I would be up at night wanting that feeling back. It was missing. My drugs and my alcohol were missing, and it was like losing a love or like losing a pet. I would, you know, be awake at night, unable to get to sleep, daydreaming about when I could feel that way again. So, the group homes had a lot of rules. I resented the fact that, you know, they would tell me what to do. And, you know, every adult, every authority figure in my life again, except for the grandparents, they were wrong. You know, everything that they said and they did, you know, was either they misjudged me or, you know, they had it wrong. And this kind of fueled my ego and this belief, this core belief that I knew what the hell I was doing and I was right. And, that's disastrous for an addict or an alcoholic. But at the time it was true. And so I ran away from these group homes a lot and I eventually got myself emancipated. And it shows, and this was further validation. I had a social worker. You can actually see I still have the papers all these years later. And it shows the drastic change that, you know, Chris is doing so much better now on his own. Now that he's emancipated, he has a job. He has this, he's that. He's attending 12-step meetings. He's doing all these things. And it was further validation that I knew what the hell I was doing. And if everyone would just leave me alone and everyone would just do things the way that I say and the way that I think, life would be great. And that's the page right out of the AA Big Book, page 61. You know, I'm like the actor that wants to run the whole show. I want to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery. And if everyone would just stay put and do things the way that I wish, the show would be great. Everyone would be pleased. But it doesn't turn out that way. It doesn't work that way. And I begin to feel that life doesn't treat me right. And so I will attempt to be even nicer or more gracious, or I might be mean, whatever the case may be. And still the play doesn't suit me. And that's me. That's me. I'm the director trying to run the whole show because I was convinced that I knew better than everyone else and I could manage my life. At the time, the evidence seemed to show that that was true, and very quickly that would change. I can remember, you know, my first meeting, it happened purely by chance, or, you know, as I would say today, it was a God thing. I was over, at a crack house that I normally, hung out at, you know, being one of these wayward teenagers that just kind of wandered around from, you know, and I say crack house, I mean, you know, dope house. It wasn't necessarily crack, but, you know, there'd be a good 12 kids, you know, and grown adults ranging from 14 years old to 60 years old in this house at all times. We nicknamed it College House because it was on College Avenue. And I have a lot of stories about College House. There's a guy that just jumped on my Instagram when I talked about sharing this meeting that I hadn't heard from him in years, named Mo, who knows me from College House, and I guess he got 4.5 years sober, so another one of these miracles that I get to see it witness here, sober in this program. But so, at College House, I had a best friend there and I would hang out there all the time. We got raided, I was part of a raid. The police busted down the door. I had to put my hands up. They paraded us out onto the front lawn, and all these cars were passing by. It was, you know, it was pretty intense to, you know, be in a SWAT type scenario like that. And I remember being in the car, and you know, our good friend Jim that I looked up to, I guess he had a gun, and he had just seen his little baby for the first time within, I don't know, 10 minutes before they raided the house. And these cops were cracking jokes about, you know, how they were surprised the baby didn't have 12 fingers or some kind of deformation. And I remember being bitter and resentful in the back of the car as they carted me off to yet another group home, because that's what they do with kids in the system that they can't pin a crime on. I've walked around police stations with drug paraphernalia on me, with drugs on me, and not been caught. I've been searched 8 times, and they never, you know, and I had a glass pipe in my sock that I just crunched around the Livermore Police Department. Crunch, 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 crunch. Searched me 4 times and never found it. So many times I got so lucky. But they would send me to a group home, and then I would hop out the window and, you know, beg for money at BART, which is our local, you know, subway, or train. And, I would be back, within a matter of hours and start the process all over again. And eventually, one of the kids there was court ordered to go to meetings, and I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. I had no prior anything. I had no idea what any of that was. So he had to explain it to me while he was trying to get me to come with him. And once he explained what it was, my response was, are you freaking kidding me? Why would I want to go to do that? No. And he begged and he pleaded. And finally he said, well, what if I give you a line? Then would you go with me? And so the first meeting I went to was a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous that I was bribed to go to with a line of methamphetamine. And I went to this meeting and I sat down in front of one of these little things that you're supposed to read. And I didn't realize that I could have just passed that to somebody else or sat in a different chair. I thought I had to read it because it was in front of me. And so I did read it and I started reading it really, really fast. And then I looked up and everyone was staring at me and I went, oh crap, they know. So I slowed down and started reading really, really slow and extra enunciating. And then I went, oh no, that's going to be a giveaway too. So I started speeding back up. And I mean, it was just a mess and I wanted to get out of there as fast as possible. But the one thing that I got from that meeting was that I do remember the feeling that everyone there was just like me. I'll go ahead and fast forward a little bit because that's more than I ever share of my, my own personal story and my background. This all ended up where, of course, there was a girl. There's always a relationship. She was the one that did it for me. It ended in, my rock bottom of rock bottoms. She became my higher power. Everything, centered around her. My whole life and thinking was centered around her. And I was head over heels, dramatic teenager, twilight in love. And I went and did everything that I possibly could to, make my life completely about her. And when it turned out she was human and she hurt me, I really went off the deep end. I had managed to put together, just going to meetings and being social, never getting a sponsor, never working a step. So I'd managed to put together about a year and a half drive. I went to meetings. I secretaried meetings. I was part of service. I went to the 1998 World Convention where there was like 20,000 sober people. Elton John was there. Robin Williams was there. There were all these famous people, and there were thousands of people that were happy and clean and sober. And I had the good fortune of that old fashioned AA where, the older guys would just, kidnap me and take me to a meeting or take me to a convention and not tell me where we're going or when we're coming back. And they would just do stuff like that. I had these experiences and, they kept me dry, but nothing fundamentally changed in me inside. I really did feel like the steps were just something you did if you wanted to become a better person. I was already kind of a good person to begin with, so they weren't really anything I needed to be concerned with. I just needed to just not drink and just not use. and at that point, I was still convinced that my only problem was drugs and the wrong people and all these authority figures. So she changed that for me, and for better or worse, I am who I am today because of that. So what happened when she, broke my little heart is, I went way off the deep end and, as far as I could possibly go. I had managed to hustle my way into a very high paying white collar job. I went from making minimum wage working at, Togo's sandwich shop for minimum wage, to making $22 an hour overnight in 1999, which was a lot of money for an 18-year-old kid. I used that, to go crazy. And, honestly, I had no intention of coming back from that. So I was trying to drown myself, drink myself, and drug myself to death over a relationship, and just being a dramatic kid. And so that's what I did. I went out and I bought a giant bag. I spent $800 on it. I also had these, you know, delusions of grandeur, because by this time I had become popular, and I really liked that validation. I'm one of these alcoholics who, when you treat me special, I feel average. And when you treat me average, I feel rejected. So at that time in my life, I had to work extra hard to make sure everyone saw me as great. Everything was extreme, because if you didn't see me as great, then it was like rejection. And so, you know, I did everything to the max, and I thought of myself as like some kind of like little 18-year-old mobster mafia kid. I was 5'8". I was still scrawny, but, you know, I was a pretty good looking kid. I was pretty good with people socially. And I created my own little, you know, mafia of, you know, drug dealers that would go sell drugs for me. I happen to know that there's 112 grams and a quarter pound. I happen to know that because that was my habit. That was my weekly habit. I would spend $3,000 a week on drugs. And, you know, I know people, especially the diehard AAAs, are going, okay, where's the alcohol in this? I'll tell you where the alcohol is. So I ended up this way because of beer. It wasn't that I rushed right out and went to drugs. What I did, I tried to prove that I was a normal person. It was beer. I drank beer, hanging out with some friends and trying to impress some girls, and nothing bad happened. I didn't break out in purple polka dots. I went to work the next day. I didn't immediately need another one. Everything was fine. And that, to me, was proof that I could drink like a normal person. And so the next weekend, I gave myself permission to drink beer again. And the same thing happened. Everything was fine, and so I could have two. And, and I kept this up for about 6 months, and people from the meetings, I would see them in public, and I'd say, hey, it's great. This is great. I'm fine. It turns out I'm actually normal. I can drink. As long as I just drink beer and I don't do any drugs, I'm fine. And I believed it. And it didn't work out that way, because eventually the drugs and stuff crept their way back in, and every time life would show up and get bad and there'd be something that was too great for me to handle, I would just go all overboard, and I had no effective mental defense against it whatsoever. So I'll share one last little story. I remember being in this house shortly before I lost it, and, you know, on my mission to just drown myself, I was having this great big party for my birthday, and I had all these people over, and this guy had brought over something called tequisa, which I don't even think they make anymore. It was a beer mixed with tequila, and he brought it over, and so I tried one, and this is okay. And we were partying. I was going from room to room, micromanaging everybody like I did, and drinking. And then, you know, I started to run into the walls, and the walls were running into me, and I started to feel kind of spinny and dizzy, and then I went, you know, my paranoia kicked in, and I was convinced that someone had drugged me. And so I'm I'm going from room to room yelling at people, and I was a real prick and a real cocky, you know, kid at this age. This is about, you know, 18, 19 years old. The way that I talked to people, everything was condescending. Everything was like I was barking orders. And so I'm yelling at people, who drugged me? Who put something in my drink? And I'm going from, was it you? Was it you? And I'm grabbing all these people. And then finally someone says, Chris, calm down. Calm down. Look, you're the only one drinking. And I looked at all these bottles everywhere. I thought, how could that be possible? What do you mean? And oh, it's true. I was the only one drinking. I found out that it's not normal to get up through your day and get ready to go to work and have a beer in the shower. It turns out regular people don't do that. This all ended up with, you know, me being insane. I was opening up holes in the walls. I was shredding furniture. because it smelled bad in my little apartment. And I had thought that people were like putting dead bodies in my couch and trying to plant evidence on me. And I was certifiably nuts. I was assaulted. I won't get too deep into that. But I was drugged, and the shock of it, and the denial that I went through for the next few months, kind of triggered these voices. And they would never talk to me. They would never give me the respect of talking directly to me. They would talk about me. So what I would hear when I say I heard voices is whispers. I would hear whispers, and it was always girls, and they were always, it's like they're in the wall. They would talk about me. I could be in my own room, and I would take my shirt off to dress, and then I would hear, he's so skinny. Look at him. You know, it was bad, and I was certifiably insane. I had gone from this huge promising career and, you know, getting this great, you know, jump start at life to, you know, the bottom very, very quickly. And I ended up homeless. I ended up out for about a year and a half, completely homeless. And I don't mean the kind of couch surfing and you're still a cute kid and people are letting you crash on the couch. I mean, homeless, you know, where I would be in a sleeping bag in the bushes and the sprinklers would come on at 5 a.m. I mean, being so cold because my body temperature had dropped. To, you know, trying to find a gas station that would let me in that had hot water so I could warm up my hands and take a Chevron shower, which is, you know, a phrase that we kind of call that sometimes. And still, it took me even then another year before I found anything even resembling sobriety. I don't feel like I have enough time for my angel story, but there was some person who...
There's definitely enough time on my end.
Okay, great. Well, I'll tell it then. So, you know, one of the two worst parts of that bottom, that rock, absolute rock bottom, is I lost that apartment. By that time, it was completely trashed. It turns out the smell was just because I had bags upon bags upon bags of garbage that I did not take downstairs to the dumpster because I didn't want anyone to see me. Some people will relate to that and what that is, but I just didn't want anyone to see me. I didn't want them to see my garbage. And the fact that I had like 12 bags of moving garbage in my house. I moved in with a neighbor for a short while. And the neighbor did a lot of drugs and did a lot of drinking. And, you know, this was a big one on my fourth step because it was one of those yets that as a cocky kid, I thought separated me from real addicts and real alcoholics. And, I'm there at her house. And so it's her alcohol, it's her drugs. I have to wait. This is the worst thing in the world. And I'm in her room and she was, you know, probably 20 years my senior. It's common in our world to have these big age gaps and, you know, she was sitting there on her bed and she had just pulled out a glass pipe and I thought, freaking finally. And I'm sitting there in the corner nursing a drink and just as it would be, you know, about to be my turn, they're scratching at the door and it's her little daughter. And by little, I mean, she couldn't have been, you know, more than 3 years old. She could walk, but that was about it. And she opens the door and my thought, because, you know, selfish and self-centered and, I'm an addict and alcoholic was, God damn it. It's supposed to be my turn, you know, and, she grabs the baby and she puts the baby on her lap. And what I did not expect is exactly what happened. I would have never imagined this in a million years. She puts the baby on her lap and she proceeds to continue. And I sat there witnessing this and I'm watching this woman, smoking methamphetamine, crystal meth with a toddler on her lap. And I started to shake, you know, every part of me down to my bones, was just like, holy crap. What am I watching? What's happening? What is this? It was like evil incarnate. But it got worse because then she handed me my churn. And I hesitated. I just kind of stared at her for a minute. And I saw my right hand reach, and it was shaking. And it grabbed it. And I took that hit, and I blew it in the corner away from the baby. And I immediately felt, you are just the biggest piece of crap. You are trash. And everything that everyone has ever said about you is true. You're garbage. And then I watched this little toddler, and, you know, I don't know if this is just the way that I remember it, but over the next few days, I remember watching this kid bumping into walls and things. It just didn't seem like that kid was developing properly. And I just knew that I played a role in that. I contributed. And so that was something I carried on my conscience that when we, I think it's in A Vision for You in our AA big book, we talk about, you know, we, hope would never see the light of day. These secrets that we want to keep, that we don't want anyone to know because, you know, we're ashamed. And that shame, that terror that anyone would know that we did something so awful, it weighs on you. And so my last, my angel moment, I had ended up sleeping on the floor of some punk kid, some high school kid that I didn't like and he didn't like me. I was really kind of out of options at that point. So that was common. And he kicked me out in the middle of the night after a fist fight. And I'm walking down East Avenue in Livermore, which is very, very long. If anyone's familiar with the Bay Area, it's kind of like walking down Mission. Mission, East 14th, and International Boulevard are all the same street. It's the longest street in the Bay Area, and it just seems like it goes on forever and ever and ever. And East Avenue kind of felt like that. It took me a good 2 hours to get from one end all the way to the other end. And the only place I was going to another dope house where I knew they hated me, and they were going to turn me away, and there was no chance they were going to let me stay there. But I had no other option, nowhere to go. I didn't know what to do. And all of a sudden, I get down by the railroad tracks, and this car pulls up, and it's this guy, and it's a guy that I had seen at that house I was headed to the last time I had been there, and I had him pegged as a cop. I thought he was a narc, he kind of caught me off guard. He was an Asian dude, and this is significant for another reason that I'll get into very, very shortly. He's very clean cut, and it was one of those gutted cars, like an undercover cop car. He had a white shirt that was obviously clean, black pants, black boots. I mean, just cop, cop, cop. And he opened his passenger door and he looked at me and he said, "Are you going to get in?" And I thought, "Are you crazy? Like, you could be an axe murderer." And there was that little voice in my head, a different little voice. And it said, "What have you got to lose? Maybe he'd be doing you a favor at this point." And I said, "Okay." And I got in the car. And this guy took me around for the rest of the night, all night long, going from apartment parking lot to apartment parking lot. And he talked to me. He told me that I needed to accept what I had done with my life. I needed to accept what had happened. He, you know, tried to talk to me about God, and I tried to shut him down, and say, you know, "I don't believe in any of that crap." And he looked at me dead in my eyes and said, "Some things are true whether you believe in them or not." And it resonated with me. And he went on for the rest of the night, teaching me basic things. He said, "Water is free. It's perfectly legal to sleep in a park in the middle of the day." He basically taught me how to accept that I was homeless, which was a hard pill to swallow, because my pride, you know, I needed to be the coolest. I needed to be the best. I was the kind of kid that would not wear a jacket somebody would offer because it didn't match and it didn't look cool. I was the kind of kid that wouldn't be on a bus because if I was on a bus, you would know I didn't have a car. Everything was about looks and appearances and that pride and that ego. And I took his advice, and for another year, I continued to drink and use and struggle and try to manage and try everything I possibly could. And I just could not. It continued, but he sparked an idea. He planted a seed in my head. Maybe there is a God. I ended up in San Leandro. My dad had invited me to come share an apartment in a sober living environment, clean and sober living apartments. I would be renting a room, and they said they would let me move into the room without putting a deposit or paying the first month's rent if I would come work for my dad, who was their maintenance guy. So I did construction work for them at a very low wage, which was so beneath me. and I moved in, and my roommate kept asking me, he would do this every day, if I wanted to go to the Hayward Fellowship. I wanted to go to an AA meeting with him, and I would alternate between explaining to him that I'm not an alcoholic, and two, I've done all that crap before. And nevertheless, he would continue to offer. Eventually I said yes. And one day I went, but I couldn't just go just as is. I did what I did when I was homeless. One of my sobriety brothers said that I should mention that when I was homeless and living in the bushes, I swept the bushes. I swept the dirt. And I would emerge from the trees and the bushes wearing a tie and a dress shirt and dress shoes because I did not want anyone to know, you know. Yeah, that's a favorite story of his. I don't know why, but I did the same thing in my very first meeting at the Hayward Fellowship. I wore a tie. I must have weighed 115 pounds. I mean, I looked like Gollum. My bones were popping right out of my face. But I didn't want anybody to know that anything was wrong with me. And I went to those meetings, and I continued to go, and I continued to go, and I continued to go because I was out of options at that point. And my plan hadn't worked. I wasn't dead yet. Honestly, that's what I had been wanting, and it just it didn't happen so easily. I was still alive. And so I went to these meetings because I was just all out of answers, all out of options, and I just did. And then one day, this guy walked in, and he didn't sound like anyone I had ever heard before. And he had the exact same eyes as that. You know, the reason I call him an angel in my angel story, I left this part out, is because I had went back to that dope house to ask about this guy, and they didn't know who I was talking about. I searched. The internet was a thing still at that time. I searched, and the car, I had written down the license plate. It didn't exist. Everyone who, you know, would remember this guy didn't remember this guy. And so that quote-unquote angel story, anyone besides me that would have remembered him doesn't remember him. And that is why I call it what I call it, because, you know, to me, that was God reaching out to me and doing for me what I couldn't do for myself directly. So Ed, who became my sponsor, reminded me of him, and he had the same eyes, and he talked the same way, and he had my attention right away. I asked him to be my sponsor, and my hands were all shaking. I was nervous because my experience with 12-step programs is sponsorship had all these conditions. You know, you need to call me every day, never lie to me. You need to go to a meeting every day, blah, 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 blah. All these things. And I told him, I said, honestly, I don't know if I could do that. And, he smiled and he said, well, I don't think I could do that either. And it blew me away. What are you talking about? Aren't these the conditions of sponsorship? Don't I have to? And he said, I'm an alcoholic. I can't manage my own life. You know, I wouldn't be able to do that. I wouldn't expect any different from you if you're a real alcoholic. He said that he would be honored to sponsor me, and I thought that was weird. It was not what I was expecting at all. It was not my experience with 12-step programs. Ed made a beginning with me. He got me into the big book. I read pages 62 and 63 pretty much religiously for a good year and a half. He did all the things that a good sponsor would do. Instead of making me reliant on him, he made me reliant on the steps and on the book. He always pointed me back to the big book, even the point where, you know, when it was frustrating, I would say, Ed, I know you know the answer. What should I do? And he would say, I don't give advice. I can't give advice. I don't listen to myself. you definitely should listen to me. you know, we pray. What's the saying in the big book? He was embodying the steps. He was showing me something I had never seen anyone do before. He would give me things. He would buy me a pack of cigarettes. He would, you know, take me through the humiliating process of shopping and buying me groceries. When I had a job, I had just blown all of my money. And I was humiliated, and I told him so. And he said, you know, the difference between humiliation and humility is my ego. That's it. I could be doing the same thing. It's just my ego, whether I'm being humble or humiliated. And when I would tell him no, as you know, I grew up with this, I would say no to everything because everything was obligatory. If I accepted a gift from you, then I was obligated to do something for you at a later date because that's how I was. Everything was transactional. Everything was transactional. So if you did something for me, that meant I had to do something for you. And consequently, if I did something for you, I was going to cash in on it later and remind you, hey, you remember when I did that for you? I need a favor. And that's how, you know, I thought friendships worked. That's how I thought everything worked. And Ed, when I would shush him away and say, no, he would smile and he would say, when you learn to give graciously, you'll learn to receive with grace. And it didn't make any sense, but I would take the stupid pack of cigarettes and shut up. And, and Ed made that beginning with me and he got me into the big book and he started telling me what an alcoholic is. And we talked about, you know, that phenomenon of craving and most importantly, the mental obsession that I can't break. I learned that it isn't my fault that I'm an alcoholic or an addict, but that I am accountable. And that if I am a real alcoholic, I am going to drink again. And no human power can do anything about that, that I really am hopeless. These were not the words I was expecting to hear. But that's what it says in the big book, and that's what he pointed me to, unless an entire psychic change can occur. Everything in my mind was broken, and it all had to change. It all had to go. There's that Zen proverb where, you know, this fancy professor comes to the Zen master to come learn. He tells him about all his credentials and how he teaches Buddhism, and he says, will you teach me your Zen? And the Zen master says, sure, but, you know, first let's have some tea. And he invites him in and, he sets out tea, pours a cup for himself. And then he starts to pour a cup for his guests, his distinguished guests. And, he just keeps pouring and pouring and pouring to the point where it starts to overflow. And this, man with all this notoriety, he goes, master, stop. It's overfull. What are you doing? And the Zen master smiles and he says, well, you know, you can't fill a cup that's already full. And this was me. You know, I had all these preconceived ideas, notions, and, they were, preventing me from learning anything new. It looks like I'm way over time. So, where do you think we're at in here? I think I should, hurry along.
Well, you were going to leave out the angel moment, so I'm afraid to have you go any shorter than what you planned on doing. I can't believe you were going to leave that out. I'm comfortable with whatever you're comfortable. You can continue on as you have on your notes there.
I completely ignored the notes. So what I'm going to do now, perfect. I think, let me hit these notes and we can wrap up.
I want to hear how it is today. So following your story along, we've gotten to the beginning of your sobriety and you can,
which is the most important part for me. So yeah, I'm going to go ahead and continue with that now. So,
perfect.
You know, Ed, demonstrated humility for me, in working these steps. He showed me, which is essential in what I try to do with my own sponsees and when I carry the message. He didn't give me advice. He didn't give me conditions. He showed me. As an alcoholic, the guilt and the shame and the ego and the pride. I learned in my fourth step that all of these things come from fear. They're self-centered fear. One, two, and three can happen very, very quickly. It's almost, one and two are almost educational. And there are principles behind these steps. We had this grand plan that I was going to take the third step at the Japanese Garden, and it was going to be this big elaborate thing. And instead what happened is, I ended up, after about a month of sobriety, I ended up going back out. And, the very next day I was convinced. It says in our big book on page 60, being convinced we were at step three. I was absolutely convinced that I was an alcoholic and I could no longer manage my own life, and that no human power could relieve it, and that there might be a God, some kind of higher power that could help me, and had led me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was absolutely convinced. And so rather than this big elaborate third step ceremony at some fancy Japanese garden, I settled for the filthy, dirty Hayward Fellowship floor in front of everybody. And I would have previously been embarrassed. I embraced it. And I got down on my hands and my knees and I prayed with him. And I said that prayer. I launched immediately into the fourth step because, as I was told, the proof that you're working the third step is that you do the fourth step. It's what's right in front of you, and it's what your God has obviously led you to. So this launching into immediate action is our way. Steps four through nine are the process of Alcoholics Anonymous, the process of recovery. All of the promises that we get, the daily reprieve that's contingent on the maintenance of the spiritual experience, all of the relief that we get from being alcoholics and alcoholism comes from four through nine in that process. I had to get to know me. And the problem was I judged myself by my intentions and who I meant to be, and other people judged me by my actions and what I did. And there was always a disconnect between the two. And that's one of the reasons I was so defensive and so sensitive. One of the things that I've learned in sobriety is that what other people think is none of my business. They're allowed to be wrong. They're allowed to have opinions, and they're allowed to think whatever they need to think. And it's just okay. Launching into that fourth step, what I learned about myself is that I'm selfish. You know, the dictionary defines that as being primarily concerned with oneself, one's thinking. And that's me. All day long, I was thinking about me, not what I could pack into the stream of life, not how I could be of service, not other people. I was thinking about me. And even when other people were involved, it was how they affected me or what they could do for me or what they did to me. And I went during this process of taking these steps from being a victim of life to being a volunteer in life. H&I was essential for me. Hospitals and institutions, for anybody that's not familiar, is where we take an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, similar to this online recording. We take it into some place where they're not able to get out. So prisons, mental institutions, rehab, any kind of place where they're not able to freely get out and go to an AA meeting, we take that message to them. Some people call it the last real 12-step call, because in the old days, that's what Dr. Bob and Bill would do. They would actually go out and look for an alcoholic and bring the meeting to them. They would go 12-step them, rather than someone just wandering into a the process of a spiritual experience or spiritual awakening is different to different people. Some people have the big burning bush variety. Some people, it's a gradual, succession of aha moments. Putting step three to the test is something that happens all of the time. And coming back down to step one is something that happens all of the time. There are promises after each and every step. I found that the ones that I really wanted, what I'd always been after my entire life, were those 10-step promises that tell me that if I'm tempted, I will recoil as from a hot flame, for by this time, sanity will have returned. That's what I was looking for, that we have ceased fighting anything and anyone. That's what I was looking for. But each of these steps has a promise, and if you look in the big book, you'll see it'll describe a condition. And immediately after, it'll give me a promise. And so what I tell sponsees and other people in meetings is if that promise does not apply to you today, you're not there today. You need to go back. And one of the things that happens, especially with long-term sobriety, is that we get into this kind of spiritual pride. We get into this denial where, you know, we go back to being fine. You know, someone will call us out on a resentment. Well, no, I don't have a resentment. Well, yeah, I do. I have resentments all the time. And if I didn't have resentments and people didn't make me angry and I didn't get pissed off, and God didn't give me opportunities to practice patience and practice love and tolerance, then there would be no program to work, right? The serenity prayer, something that's important to me because I think people get peace wrong. We think of peace as solitude. You'll see it on Instagram. Someone is out alone in the wilderness, and they will tag it serenity and peace. And that's not been my experience. One time I was waiting for the train to arrive, and there was a little blind man, and I gave him a wide berth because the train was about to arrive. I want to make sure he can get on the train okay. And he starts walking and making his way through once the doors open. And I kid you not, at the exact same time, a very large woman with a dog comes rushing into that door, and they get stuck. And the two of these people, this woman with the dog and the little old man, are wedged inside the door, wiggling, and they're both, you know, kind of screaming out. And the old man is saying, "I'm sorry, I can't see you, I'm blind." And the large woman is yelling, "Why don't you watch where you're going? Can't you see I'm blind?" This is a true story. This really happened. I watched it happen right in front of me. And I get on this train, and she's on one end of the car, and he's on the other end. And he's sitting perfectly silent. She's on the other end, and she's trash-talking this guy and going, "That guy, that piece of crap. You know, I'm blind. He should be looking where he's going." And I told this story to my sponsor at the time, and he said, "Well, which one would you rather be? Which one do you think had peace?" You know, I can let people be wrong. I can let people be who they are and be on their own path and let that be okay. And that is submitting to God's will, because they're right where they're supposed to be. And anytime I disagree and don't accept with the way someone is or the way the day is going or the way the meeting is going or any of these things, I'm complaining about God's plan and his handiwork. And so truly taking it right back to step one, and surrendering, 1, 2, 3, you know, to his will, "Thy will, not mine, be done," means that I need to accept that God's got it all under control. I do a terrible job at it, and I need to surrender. My last little bit of notes is that, you know, I had taken a sponsee to a family reunion one year, and he... as we do, he was having a difficult time helping me put together this tent, and he got really upset, and finally just threw it down, and I sat down on the picnic table, and I picked up Daily Reflections. I said, "Why don't we just, you know, read and take a break for a minute?" And he said, "You think that book is going to help put up this tent? We need to put up the tent. Book's not going to put up the tent." I said, "We should just take a break, and let's read the book, and let's let God handle that, right?" Said, "You know, you're so convinced these books can just solve everything." He picked up the book and he threw it at the tent, and he said, "There, you see, it didn't put up the tent, did it?" And so eventually, after I was quiet for long enough, he goes and he picks up the book, and he kind of wanders back over and sits down begrudgingly, and we read. And we finished reading. He felt a little bit better. We took a nice little break. We walked over to that tent, and I swear, the tent went up with ease within seconds, just like magic. That's how life works. That's serenity. That's peace. I don't necessarily need everything to go my way. Serenity is being okay in spite of myself and in spite of the world around me. Not relying on people, places, or things to go the way I think they ought to go, but by just seeing where I fit in. Carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, I try to humble myself. I try to remember that I have a responsibility to carry the message the way that it was given to me, not put my little twist on it, not make it Chris's way or Chris's message, but to point newcomers back to the big book and to give them what I got. An old timer had once told me that if I don't, I'm robbing them of the opportunity that was given to me. The way that this has changed my character, sometimes is small. I picked up new shortcomings I didn't have 18 years ago. A lot of the shortcomings I had when I came in are gone. They've never returned. The desire to drink and use has never come back. They've been removed permanently for me. I'm not who I was by a long shot, and I am immensely grateful for the little things. I am the kind of person today who takes honesty very seriously. I try not to give people false expectations and to stay humble. I don't promise my wife that I'm not going to let her down. In fact, I go out of my way to tell her I'm probably going to let you down. That's how I keep myself honest and how I remind myself that, I really just have today. I could be back out there tomorrow, and statistically, the odds are still against me. If I don't level my pride and my ego, I'm still in danger. I can have all of these things taken back just as easily as they were before. I had a tough year last year. My father passed away from this disease February of 2 years ago exactly. And last year I had a difficult time with a bunch of different life events. I have PTSD now. I've got anxiety. I had a bunch of life things happen. It was a rough year for me. And I've had these things happen. I raised my three children myself in sobriety. I was a single father for many, many years. And by raised, I mean the whole thing. I mean, I nursed them from 2 months old. I was the one getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to feed the baby. And I was a full custody father for many, many years. So when I say I raised my children, I really mean I did all of it. I wasn't always the most spiritual throughout that. There were times that I isolated myself and, I wanted to feel sorry for myself and I wanted to revel and roll around in my own self-pity. But I did make it through. And that's one of the things that I found, as long as I remain willing to be honest and willing to go to any lengths when push comes to shove, I have done it. I have come back. I've humbled myself. I've gotten right with God. I'm a firm believer that we're only as sick as our secrets. So I try to make it a habit, to be very honest. And say everything. I'll call up a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't care how long they've been sober. They could be sober for a year. I'll call them up in the middle of the night and say, hey, I've got XYZ going on and it's eating me up and I need an alcoholic and I need to tell on myself. And that's what I do because that's what got me sober and that's what kept me sober. When I was very young, I got sober as a young kid. I would do things even while working the steps that were creating brand new wreckage. Honesty is what allowed me to progress and to get through them. And, some people, I have a living amends that I have to make. There are some people that I continue to have to keep my character changed and grow. The last thing that I can say about how Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life. I think it's just as simple as my ego. It's just a little bit smaller than it used to be. I used to expect, to the point of paranoia, that everyone was thinking about me. And these days, I kind of expect the opposite. When people remember me, I'm like pleasantly surprised and I'm like blown away and I go, wow, you remember me. That's if you had known me 18 years ago, it is not the same person. I don't need to convince people that I'm right who I am. I'm content to let my actions and what I do define who I am. I care about my character and how I affect people's lives. And I try not to set people's expectations too highly because, I know deep down inside, I'm a liar, a cheater, and a thief. And the fact that I have not done any of those things today is a goddamn miracle. This is who I am. I'm an alcoholic. It doesn't make me a bad person. It doesn't make me evil. It doesn't make me, you know, it's just who I am, at my nature. And the fact that I'm able to do these things is only through the grace of God. As long as I continue to do what I do, I'm going to keep getting what I get. What I can tell the newcomers, if you want something you've never had, you're going to have to do something you've never done. The best thing that you could possibly do is to stop listening to yourself. Because if you're anything like me, your mind is out to get you and it is very clever. You might think that you're very smart. Maybe you are. But I can't fix me. And that all comes down to that first step. That 1-2-3 shuffle that alcoholics do where I work step 1-2-3, get a new sponsor. 1-2-3, go out and drink. 1-2-3, whatever. What that really is, not working that 4-9 process where we go from being an active alcoholic to getting all of these promises. It's not really working step one. It's the only one you need to get an A on. It's the only one you need to get right. I'm an alcoholic. I cannot manage my own life. There is a God. I'm not it. And when I try to control things, I mess stuff up and it gets worse. Yeah, so thanks for letting me share. I know that we went way over time. Feel free to, you know, cut down, edit whatever you need to. Like I said before we started, it's important to me that I carry an AA message and not just a Chris message. What I would tell any listeners is the stuff you find in the big book, that's the AA part, and the stuff that you don't find in the big book, that's the Chris part. And you take that stuff with a grain of salt because I do. And that's how I practice this first step. I for 9 years, would not pick up a year chip because I was one of these people who used it as a way to fuel my ego. And I would go, I have 2 years. I have 3 years. I have whatever. And first thing out of my mouth, how long have you been sober? How long have you been clean? And I would do this egotistical thing in the program. And the way that I smashed that was by not taking chips for 9 years until I got to a point where it became critical that I show other young people that it is possible to have long-term sobriety and get sober young. So now, every year, I'll go pick the chip. I'm looking forward to the second Saturday of May 2020, picking up an 18-year chip. And I don't do it because I want to glorify myself. I do it because I'm 38 years old, and I have a baby face still. It's important that other young people see that if you do get your nose in this book, if you do start underlining, highlighting, and following and listening to the old timers, sticking with the winners, going to not just going to meetings, but going along with what God would have you do, your God of your understanding, rather than what I think I ought to do, and accepting life on life's terms, surrendering, there is hope, and you can achieve permanent sobriety and have a new way of life that is honestly a blessing. These have all been bonus rounds for me. I'm lucky to be here. I'm eternally grateful. I could never pay back everything I've been given by this program. It's a blessing. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for allowing me that opportunity to carry the message. And I seriously doubt it, but if you do have any time for questions, I'm happy to answer. But I think that's all for me.
Thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. I have 3 pages of notes. Actually, I've not run into somebody else that does this, but in every meeting I take notes. When I was in rehab, they told me that I shouldn't do that. So, of course... 10 years later, I still take notes. And then I type them up because I forget. I forget so much. And you shared so much. One thing, I mean, there's so many things that I'm going to take with me. And I will quote you on some of these as well. Mm-hmm. But I enjoy hearing the different ways people found their way to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for you as Narcotics Anonymous. So what do you think changed your thoughts or opinions of Alcoholics Anonymous from the one part?
Absolute and total desperation. The key difference is that in Narcotics Anonymous, and again, this is just my experience, I was always told that I had a choice. You have a choice. You can choose to not use. You can choose to not pick up. And that's what I really believed. And that's where a lot of my guilt stemmed from, because I already believed that in the first place. And that roommate that finally convinced me, out of desperation, I went. I didn't think it was going to work. I thought there was no hope for me left. I mean, I was insane. I was hearing voices in my head. I thought I was done. I was the kid that, despite my age, mothers would grab their children and walk to the other side of the street to get away from me. And I didn't blame them. What was different was that these men, in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the women as well, they did not say I had a choice. They said that, you know, I'm doomed, and that I am hopeless. unless I have an entire psychic change. It was very different than hearing you have a choice, you can choose to not pick up, just go to meetings and don't pick up. They had a different message. At least I heard it differently.
So how has your opinion of AA changed from then to now? You were 20, if I did my math correctly. It was simple math.
Correct.
Okay.
I was too young to go to a bar. you know, my very first AA meeting that I didn't mention in there, I had tried to go to one once, and I started talking about drugs, and this old timer cut me off, cowboy. And he said, son, there's a place you can go, and it ain't here. That was my impression of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, when these men and women took me in at the Hayward Fellowship in AA, which is one of those lucky Alano clubs that stayed open all day long, it was vastly different. It was welcoming. My sponsor pointed out that in my mind, I could just change the word alcohol to whatever. It all came down to, do you have a desire to stop drinking? And does this describe you? Does this sound like you? Does this behavior sound like you? And everything was a yes.
And you found Ed as your sponsor. How long did he sponsor you, and do you still work with him?
I do. And at times I've used what I call my AA brothers as sponsors as well. So something that I do that, most of the people that I know with long-term sobriety do, but not everybody may do, is I treat those people, people who shared the same sponsor or got sober at the same time that happened to still be sober, which, long-term sobriety, it gets less and less the people who got sober at the same place at the same time. I use them to sponsor me as well. People are people. And, you know, the reason that I make it a point to, you know, like when it comes to my wife, I say, I will let you down. When it comes to sponsees, I say, I will let you down. And the reason that I do this is because that's how Ed was. And Ed has let me down. There have been plenty of times where, you know, he didn't answer the call, or I wanted him to be at my wedding. He didn't show up. He flaked. Ed's an alcoholic. And just because he's got 20 something years doesn't make him, it doesn't render him a saint. He's going to be an alcoholic. Now, he's a sober alcoholic who, does practice these principles, but he's not perfect by any means. And he has his own set of shortcomings. So we have this network, we have a home group, or we have, whatever, but we have this network of sober people that we can trust. And we all kind of speak the same language. You find yourself in a meeting and, if it's the big book thumpers for you, if it's the, call them muck makers, the ones that highlight and underline and circle everything, whatever it is, they speak the same language. And those are the people that, you know, I will call up and they will sponsor me in that moment, in that time, if that's what I need. That's part of humility. There are people that have been sober for 9 months who are rocking a better program than me today. And I know that. And, so this idea that, it has to be somebody with 30 years, it has to be, you know, my sponsor, my way, you know, part of doing things God's way is being willing to, adjust and adapt and get to the alcoholic that God wants me to get to.
We had this conversation recently. Do you have a sponsor forever? And somebody in our home group just celebrated 40 years and officially an old timer. I don't know, at 18 years, but 38 years old, are you an old timer or are you not an old timer? I'm not sure. You qualify at your young age.
Yeah. It's the question, isn't it?
Yeah.
By the grace of God, I've been sober all day today.
I love that. So you had, you had mentioned this little voice that would convince you, well, going back to the formula 44D, which some people may not know what it is, but when you were medicating and that little voice, do you find that you have another little voice today that guides you the right way?
It's contingent. It depends. It's like a muscle for me. My conscience and God, they're like a muscle. And if I'm doing this thing and I'm practicing these principles and, excuse me, specifically, I mean 10, 11, and 12, which I rambled so long, I didn't really get into that. But, you know, it starts with when we retire at night and then upon awakening. If I continue to practice that, then I work out that muscle and I will hear. When I don't, I don't. And there have been years where I have gone 2 or 3 years without hearing God at all. Those have been rough years. And there have been years where I feel so in tune that it's like floating. It's like a pink cloud, only it doesn't necessarily have to be for a newcomer. You can be that way right now, or in your ninth year, or in your 20th year, or whichever year. I remember a taxi driver when I was at probably peak recovery. Taxi driver had probably $800 in cash that had fallen behind his seat. And I remember being in the back, and I was poor at the time. I could have really used that money. And I looked up at him and I said, hey, man. And I pointed out that he had like, you know, several hundred dollars of cash. And he accused me of being a very honest man. I cannot tell you that I would do that today. I don't know. I might take money. I don't know. So, Tara, it depends.
What does it depend on? So talk to me about what's different. And well, I know you have other things on your schedule, but what was different in the years where you are connected, and what is different in your life when you're not connected?
Yeah, oftentimes for me, it's pain. So Ed used to say that there are two ways that people find God. And one is through virtue, and one is through desperation. And I was not of the virtuous variety. I was of the desperation variety. I found God through desperation. And that it holds true today. Pain is the touchstone of all spiritual progress. When I get in enough pain, I become willing. And that has not changed. I will do it my way for as long as I could possibly get away with, until it's too painful and it's too messy and it's becoming too much of a problem. And then, and then I'll let go. And then I will surrender, and then I will get with God and get on my knees and admit, please direct my thinking, please remove this from me. I become willing, and it's contingent on that. When I don't do it, it doesn't work.
We'll keep coming back.
Yeah, I hope to.
Is it by carrot or by stick? Maybe someday it'll be by carrot for you. So last question, and this is specific just for you. So I'm curious, after your answer to that last question, how can you improve your program in the next 3 months?
Well, I have been going to a lot more meetings over the last 6 months or so than usual. And, you know, I alluded to some of that with the PTSD and the stressful year. I'm sponsoring, people that I would not have, you know, I had an experience in December, where, I ended up sponsoring somebody that, it's probably the first time I can say I felt like God was speaking directly to me in a while. Because I, you know, tried to pass this newcomer off to other people, in every way possible. And that, okay, well, I'll take you to 3 meetings, but you really need this kind of sponsor. You really need, you know, X, Y, Z, and I really can't. And it just kept coming back to me and kept coming back to me and kept coming back to me. And, you know, there's that thing that we drill into each other in H&I that I may be the only big book they ever get. And there's a responsibility there, and being able to recognize the signs and being able to recognize that God is telling me something. It's been a while since it's been so clear. So yeah, I am especially grateful to that particular newcomer and that particular sponsee. They, balked at the porch step, and they're not in this thing right now. But I love and care for that that newcomer, because it's not just about them. It's about what I get out of it. This was validation for me. God was speaking directly to me and giving me an opportunity to carry the message. And when you've got 3 kids that, you know, my new gorgeous wife, who's, you know, a blessing. She's a full-time student, you know, working on her degree, and she also has a full-time job. A lot of the raising of the kids and the family stuff, I work from home. I'm stuck here a lot of times. I cannot do a coffee commitment or a secretary commitment. It's just not possible. So sometimes the only way that I really can carry the message is by either sponsorship or by doing what we're doing right here today. Without those opportunities, I have no way to practice that 12 step.
Well, I appreciate how you took today so seriously and made the commitment and showed up and shared your story, which might be one of my favorites. It certainly all resonated with me.
There weren't even any jokes.
So, well, I did laugh a few times anyway, despite your intentions.
I got one last one. This is very, very short, very short. So, and I love Mormons. I don't mean to offend anyone, but what do Mormons and tweakers have in common?
They always show up late.
No, they both ride bicycles and they're both on a mission.
Okay, that's pretty good. But my answer does work.
It all works.
That's pretty good. So earlier you had said, it will get me every time. You were referring to alcohol, like it'll, or drugs, it'll get you every time. And yeah, as you were sharing your story of the December newcomer, and it's like, God will get me every time now. It used to be alcohol, but it's like, now God will get me, and I can feel the burn when he's starting to work with me. And I feel this sensation of the PTSD and the anxiety and losing your father, and your 3 children can't be already raised. You're still raising them actively. Mm-hmm. So yeah, sometimes, like you had said, it's the pain that pushes the growth. And I sense God is working in you, because he'll get you every time.
Every time. Yeah, eventually. Once I, you know, we will hold on to it. Ed always had a way of saying, I will do what I do until I don't have to do it anymore. And, it's like trying to push that rock up a hill. I will still by default try to do things in self-will, and I don't notice that I'm doing it. So it's important for me to listen. It's important for me to stay connected with other alcoholics who will see it before I do. Still, You know, sobriety time doesn't mean that it becomes, 20/20 vision where I can just see myself all the time. Although, a lot of times that is true. A lot of times I can see myself while I'm about to do something and beforehand. And, that's been one of those great gifts and one of those great promises that sanity has returned. Aside from that, I still do really need other people to keep me in check and tell me. I need to be able to listen. And see that, yeah, you are kind of self-will run riot today. And I do need to dial it back down, and I am trying to run the show. And, that comes back down to that honesty, that being willing to throw it all out there. You'd be surprised, all those, you're only as sick as your secrets. People will say, don't share that at group level, only share that with a sponsor. I say, screw that. Get it out as soon as possible. Right now, because it'll eat you up and it'll kill you. And that's what I did. And I believe that the only reason that I am here today and all of those other young people are not here, is because, when it came down to it, when the push came to shove, I was willing to just blurt it out and get it out. I can remember working myself up and I had no intention. We were just telling war stories. And, sooner or later, somebody starts salivating and they're, all of a sudden someone's coming over to party. And I had like a month sober at the time and I go, holy crap, how did this just happen out of nowhere? And, I didn't even need to excuse myself. I didn't need to give a reason. For the first time in my life, I just got up and walked out the house and I walked down that street and I just kept like chanting, God be with me, God be with me, God be with me, all the way down to the fellowships, the nearest meeting. And I managed to stay sober that way. And sometimes it's like Rogue One. It's like Star Wars, the one with the Force and the Force is with me. Whatever gets me in tune, I need to be less me and get with him. And it usually happens out of desperation that I get to a breaking point where I realize, okay, you're right. I can't.
You were a great example of the program and continuing to grow in the program.
Well, it's an honor and a privilege. Thank you. I try not to think too much about myself, because I have this disease that does that for me. And again, to anybody that isn't an alcoholic who might, come across this, I hope I give a message that explains the difference that, we encourage people. If you're not convinced that you're an alcoholic, maybe you're not. Go out and try some controlled drinking. Put it to the test. I needed to be convinced. And I'm not one of those AAs that is anti-alcohol. We have wine and champagne in our house, left over from a wedding that's been there for 2 years. And I recently had an alcoholic that pointed out that's all going to turn to vinegar. And I thought, why would I care? It's just there. I don't know. But, I'm not a purist that hates people that drink, and I don't want people to change for me. I like when I come over to my grandfather's house when I would come over and he would offer me a drink and I would get an opportunity to say no. I love that. I don't need the world to change for me today. And like it says in our big book, any idea for recovery that is based on the avoiding temptation is doomed to failure, because even if we sent ourselves out to the polar ice caps, an Eskimo could turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. And so peace and serenity and real recovery means that I can go anywhere and I can do anything and I'm completely free and I behave and act like a normal human being. It's not a thing for me. It never even comes up, so long as I keep in fit spiritual condition. And oftentimes for me, what that means is that life will get a little messy and pain will get me back down on my knees and humble me, and I'll go, okay, all right, get to a meeting, get honest, get with God, ask him to remove these defects of character and turn immediately my thoughts to who I could be of service to and how I can be of help. And that process of, you know, get right with God, admit it, get into service, has always worked for me. It's never failed once.
For 18 years.
For almost 18 years. It could be 18 now. I'm not exactly sure, but we're going with May 1st. I just got it tattooed on my arm. So it's taken me all this time to make it official. And I hope like hell that, these one day at a times will add up long enough that, that this tattoo will never have to be changed.
Thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate your time.
I appreciate your time. I took much more of your time than we had. And, I warned you I'm a talker, but hopefully something that I said can be of use to someone.
Certainly. I no doubt. Well, you have a great radio voice, so it's a good one to go long.
Cool. Thank you, Tara.
Right. We'll keep in touch.
When you finish editing and you publish this, let me know, and I will I'll send it out. There's plenty of people I think that I know that would love to hear.
Yeah. Yeah, we may have to get Ed on here.
That would be great. That would be a good call. We can start turning this into one of those tag meetings where we recommend the next person.
That's right. So start working him.
All right, I will.
All right. You take care.
Thanks, Tara. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.